Hi, everyone, and welcome to the RegTech Report, your update on all things RegTech. My name is Carl Viertel, and with me is Stefan Solistio. And our mission is to bring you the latest news, speak with industry pioneers, and muse about the latest tech. Welcome back, everyone.
Hello there.
How's it going, Stefan?
Yeah, just back from my first business trip in, I don't know, like 18 months or something like that.
I was out in
like
Berlin.
It was the first time ever.
2 weeks ago. I still remembered, you know, what to do with the hotel invoice and all that. I'm kind of proud of myself.
Well, like a brave new world, isn't it?
Yeah, and meeting people and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Things are looking up, I must say. Look, we've got a couple cool things on the agenda for today. We're going to talk a little bit about ESG frameworks.
ESG.
Super hot. And then,
is that like the European song thing?
That's slightly different. And then I'm actually joined by my colleague Claudia Hove. And we're going to talk about a new regulation coming out in Germany that is going to put some additional requirements around, among other things, internal controls. And we have a very special and topical top three. Looking forward to that. On the ESG topic, I spent actually quite a bit of time with some people in our team working on sort of an ESG library chapter for the Align library. And so obviously I looked at a number of sort of frameworks is maybe the wrong word, but sort of structures and thoughts put together in documents on ESG.
I have to admit, I'm not really an expert here in this area. Maybe only some dangerous half knowledge. I was just debating, or I was just telling somebody about it, and I forgot what the G stands for. So ES is environmental, social, right? And what was the G?
Governance.
Governance. See, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're not alone, right? Because it is such a new topic that I don't think there are that many people that are deep experts or, you know, have a long career in this space. Obviously, there are climate scientists. Obviously, there are people that work on human rights and there are people that work on these governance topics. But sort of the domain of putting it into a ESG risk reporting framework is reasonably new. And to be honest, you can see it in sort of the way that it's represented in frameworks, right? So a lot of the regulators, lawmakers around the world do address the topic, but it's oftentimes more focused on process, right? So, you know, let's compare it to, you know, cyber regulation or standards like ISO 27000. It will say, all right, you should have privileged access management for logging into SAP management systems, right? There is no such thing that at least I came across in the ESG world, right? They don't say, you should check if, I don't know, flooding is going to impact your operations or something like that.
And that's also something how I took it. Why is there no change? Because people have been looking at these things also in the past. I think even they used a different acronym like CSR, also similar topics. But I think one thing that did change was that more and more legislation and hard regulation with really consequences are coming out, like supply chain and environmental stuff that you have to follow. And now it's no longer just marketing.
Yeah, I mean, a great example is, for example, the EU sustainable finance taxonomy, right? So in this EU regulation, there's a whole bunch of, you know, for example, you might address something like this, or generally there should be reporting here or things like that. And then the only area where it really becomes specific is in this taxonomy. And the taxonomy is probably, I mean, even that is a stretch, right? Because it's basically points A to F, right? Mm-hmm. So A, climate change mitigation, B, climate change adaption, right? So this is the level of specificity that these frameworks actually go down to. So I think there is a big sort of gap between, okay, so we should report on these risks, we should categorize by these dimensions, but how we get the base information is still reasonably open.
Okay. And as far as I understood, we built quite a lot of assets around that, right? And
that's a good
opportunity then.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people that put some thought into it, like the World Economic Forum and their Global Risk Report. And we talked about that in a webinar with Michael Rasmussen, right? So they do think about these big trends and the big things happening. But taking it from, again, talking about big trends and then creating a specific methodology to evaluate risk and then report on it, there's still a step between it. And one of the sort of organizations that has put quite a bit of thought into this is the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, or SASB.
That just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Are you SASBing yet? But one thing that they put a lot of thought into is basically what dimensions, and they basically have defined different domains, and they're basically doing a mapping of domains against industries, mm-hmm. right? So they're saying, okay, so if you're in mining operations, then there will be different domains that are relevant for your ESG exposure than if you're, I don't know, food delivery on e-bikes, right? Okay. And so they have a huge matrix of essentially a ton of different industries and types of businesses and these dimensions on the other axes. And then they have documents underlying that basically outline a structure of the elements that you should be looking at. So, you know, also really valuable. But I'd also say still not at a point where you can just say, okay, I'm going to ask 15 questions and I understand ESG risk.
All right. Very interesting. I mean, I definitely look forward to what people do with it over the next months.
Yeah. I mean, one of the first organizations probably that put a real charter in place to address these things are the 17 sustainable development goals from the United Nations. They're basically 17 goals that humanity needs to address in sort of a roadmap to 2030. I really like it because, again, yes, climate is important, but it's not the only thing, right? So I think the United Nations certainly put a broader focus, which, you know, really reflects sort of the ESG elements very well. And I was at VivaTech 2 years ago.
That's like ancient history. That's like pre-pandemic, isn't it?
Yeah, so it was actually really cool because the French president was there and basically announced the huge initiative that had been agreed upon with the United Nations, and you know the French government would be embarking on this initiative of supporting businesses that, you know, drive towards these 17 sustainable development goals. And I think it was, 2018 or, yeah, probably 2018 when they were formulated. So again, I think it's a really good classification taxonomy, but again, it doesn't go down to the actual details.
It sounds so familiar to other things we've been working on where, you know, it's people always talk about the high level, but if you actually have to put it in practice, that's where the devil is in the details, right? And how to do these things, that's usually where it becomes complicated.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, I think one of the really cool areas where I'm really excited to see our customers succeed in this. Because, you know, obviously we took all of those, dimensions and standards and, you know, mapped them to our content. So, you know, if you want to say, well, what does my risk look like, against aligned, defined, mega trends? I can look at it that way and then just sort of switch the view and say, okay, but what would this look like if I were looking at the United Nations 17 sustainability goals? So, you know, sort of short of the industry really embracing one standard and saying this is the definitive approach, I think this could actually be pretty interesting. And we're back. Welcome, Claudia. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
So, you're obviously always reading really exciting things about the world of risk and control. And one thing that our listeners that don't speak German need to know is that in German you can add an enormous amount of words together and create a new noun. And so the Finanzmarkt Integritätsstärkungsgesetz, or FISG, is on the table. And Claudia, you've been doing a little bit of research into that.
Yeah, so first of all, I'm going to make that a mandatory exercise on German lessons for our dear colleagues. Yeah, so maybe just to give you some context on all of this, right? So internal control as such has obviously been around for a very long time, and usually it's been having a different focus. So sometimes it's been on financial reporting, sometimes it's been on more business-related topics like production or logistics, and it's typically some sort of retrospective on the last couple of months or weeks and years. And this FISG that you mentioned is one example. At the same time, the more famous one is obviously the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which has been around for even longer. And also, just to make it not just for Germany, there is also some activity going on in the UK, where there will be a UK SOX
soon.
Yes.
So it's kind of like history is repeating itself, right? Because about 20 years ago, we were in this space, and it seems now there's a bit of a renaissance.
Potentially another focus on financial reporting, yes.
Mm-hmm. And we still haven't moved too far past the concept of internal controls.
Yeah, so the major areas of that new law can be pretty much summarized in three core areas. One of them is sort of the internal perspective. The other one is a supervisory board perspective, which I think is fairly relevant and important, to be honest. And last but certainly not least is an external auditor perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Obviously for very good reasons.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, honestly, I don't know enough about it, but do you think this is a response to the whole Wirecard situation we have here in Munich?
Yes, certainly. So if we look at maybe the last one first, the external auditor perspective, there's going to be some relevant changes, like e.g. there will be a dedicated communication channel between the external auditor and the supervisory board, where the executive board is not involved. So if they think there's relevant aspects where the top management shouldn't be part of, then they can have that conversation without them. Also, there is new requirements for rotating both the external audit company, but also rotating the relevant partner in that auditing company, which has been under discussion for a very long time.
Yeah.
Also, I think it's
obviously limits some career moves of the big four folk.
Yeah, that's a nice link into the other one, where the non-audit services, as the experts call it, will be monitored a lot more closely. And there will also be new fines introduced on that.
Yeah, I mean, the EU has been talking about that for a long time. I mean, to be honest, the big four are very good at avoiding that, to be honest. Do you think this one has teeth?
I think so, yes, absolutely. Also because there will be a chapter on increased liabilities, which obviously external audit people don't like at all.
Yeah, I remember some approvals I needed to go through for some big four contracts. Yep.
Yes, yeah. So that's going to be probably the toughest one for the big four and the other players in the market.
And the internal view?
Yeah, so the internal view is going to be a more mandatory and more formalized requirement to have both internal control and risk management systems introduced in a company, which is, to be fair, only relevant for publicly listed companies, but still.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a pretty big trend. I mean, we're seeing this in so many large markets. And, you know, for most global organizations that have a significant presence in the UK or the EU, it's going to be a big topic, and thereby, you know, similar to GDPR, that just became sort of the global privacy standard just because you couldn't exclude that someone would be affected by it in the EU. I think similarly, the EU and the UK certainly do have that power, I guess, to make it a global standard.
Yeah, what I think is also very exciting about that law is the middle part, so to say, the supervisory board part. So there's a few aspects where, you know, me being naive, I would have thought that this is at least a good practice already. So for instance, having two financial experts being part of the supervisory board, I would have thought that's a no-brainer, especially in the listed companies. But obviously, it was included in the law for probably good reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I think the there are probably a lot of experts on these supervisory boards, but there are probably also a lot of people that just wanted a cushy job after being a CEO of something else for a while. And
yeah, for sure.
Do you think that era is maybe not coming to an end, but might be infringed upon?
I think it's certainly coming to an end. There's various initiatives on that. There's various offers to be a qualified supervisory board member, which I think is for a good reason as well. And also, if we look at the other requirement in that law, which is to have an audit committee mandatorily established in supervisory boards. And I think that's something that's also, you know, one of my assumptions that, of course, if it's a large enough company, of course, you would have an audit committee to make sure you've got the right expertise in that board.
Yeah. Well, exciting times. It's something we certainly will have to watch and see how that develops. And more importantly, then becomes reality. I think we've seen too often these laws theoretically exist, but then sort of be slightly toothless in implementation.
Yes, and as you say, implementation. So some of these aspects have been put into effect immediately, so already in July, and other areas will be in effect with January. So it's not a long transition period, I guess.
All right. So, Claudia, I thought we might do a special top three. Are you in?
Of course.
Hey. Hey. Oh.
Top three.
It's the
top three.
So, Claudia, I don't know if you followed this, but the sort of most decadent element of 2021 is happening, the billionaire space race, right?
Yeah, I followed that.
So Richard Branson, a few days ago, took off in his Virgin Galactic thing, which is sort of strapped to the bottom of a massive aircraft and then is taken up to 40,000 feet and then blown into the, well, low. It's not, I guess, not Earth orbit, but enough to be in zero G for a while. Now, one of the sort of side notes on this story, which I found incredibly entertaining, is he did sell some tickets. And one guy bought a ticket for like $250,000 and then didn't show up.
Yeah, so, I had to laugh about that one too.
So my question is, there has to be a really, really good reason. So should we do a top three? What are your top three reasons that you would not show up for $250,000 flight to space to be one of the first civilians in space?
Yeah, let's do that.
Do you want to start with your number three?
Yeah, well, looking back on my personal lockdown experience, I guess I wouldn't have shown up if I have had a hairdresser appointment.
That's very specific, but
yeah.
All right.
Very important, obviously, for some people.
Okay. So my number three reason why I wouldn't have shown up is being hungover, because I cannot imagine anything worse than being shot into low Earth orbit, being massively hungover. So maybe this guy like arrived in the desert in the Mojave Desert, whatever, got hammered the night before and is like, yeah, no, I'm out. No,
definitely.
Your number two reason why you wouldn't show up.
Well, obviously, I wouldn't have had $250,000 cash at home. So maybe my bank would have canceled the credit.
Ah, defaulting.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah, probably not something banks want to finance, given that collateral is being blasted into low Earth orbit. So my number two is a bit abstract, but it's sort of, I don't know if this is sort of within the rules, but my number two reason is time travel.
Okay.
Okay, so if I had the ability to, if someone had invented time travel, then I would have gone there, gone back in time, and then gone to space, but also had the ability to time travel. It's sort of like when you get a genie, right? And, you know, you get three wishes and your first wish is unlimited wishes. That.
Okay, I get it.
All right, your top reason why you wouldn't show up?
Yeah, I guess I would have canceled the trip if they had told me in advance that I wouldn't be able to drink champagne.
Hmm. What happens with the bubbles without gravity?
I don't know. How would you even drink in gravity?
Oh, straws.
Straws. Well, champagne and straws.
Hmm. All right, so hairdressers and champagne. So my number one reason why I wouldn't have showed up is because in the billionaire space race, I would probably want to go on Elon's rocket. Okay. So first of all, the rocket is a lot cooler, right? It's actually a proper rocket and, you know, flies into proper space as opposed to, you know, a glorified airplane. Or, as in case of Jeff Bezos, something that looks less like a dick. It does. It just does.
It's also very specific.
And so I think going to space in Elon's rocket, like in one of the Falcons or whatever, would certainly be cooler than the Virgin.
Understood. So it's about coolness.
Definitely. I mean, you have to, you know, pick and choose who you want to be associated with. Absolutely. In the billionaire space race.
I'll certainly remember that.
Well, with that, Claudia, thanks so much for wrapping up the episode with us. Really appreciate it, and look forward to being back with Stefan in our next episode.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. Let's continue the conversation on Twitter. Follow our dedicated podcast handle at the RegTech Rep. Make sure to rate this podcast and send your thoughts and comments to the RegTech Report at align.com. Once again, that's the RegTech Report at ALYNE.com. You can also follow Align on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Twitter, or catch up on our podcasts on align.com/the RegTech Report.